Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, Chapters 13, 14, and 15.
Chapter 13. Some new acquaintances are introduced to the intelligent reader, connected with whom various pleasant matters are related, appertaining to this history. "Where's Oliver?" said the Jew, rising with a menacing look. "Where's the boy?" The young thieves eyed their preceptor as if they were alarmed at his violence, and looked uneasily at each other, but they made no reply. "What's become of the boy?" said the Jew, seizing the dodger tightly by the collar, and threatening him with horrid imprecations. "Speak out, or I'll throttle you." Mr. Fagin looked so very much in earnest that Charlie Bates, who deemed it prudent in all cases to be on the safe side, and who conceived it by no means improbable that it might be his turn to be throttled a second, dropped upon his knees and raised a loud, well-sustained, and continuous roar, something between a mad bull and a speaking trumpet. "Will you speak?" thundered the Jew, shaking the dodger so much that his keeping in the big coat and all seemed perfectly miraculous. "Why, the traps have got him, and that's all about it," said the dodger, sullenly. "Come, let go of me, will you?" And, swinging himself, at one jerk, clean out of the big coat, which he left in the Jew's hands, the dodger snatched up the toasting fork and made a pass at the merry old gentleman's waistcoat, which, if it had taken effect, would have let a little more merriment out than could have been easily replaced. The Jew stepped back in this emergency with more agility than could have been anticipated in a man of his apparent decrepitude, and, seizing up the pot, prepared to hurl it at his assailant's head. But Charlie Bates, at this moment, calling his attention by a perfectly terrific howl, he suddenly altered his destination and flung it full at that young gentleman. "Why, what the blazes is in the wind now?" growled a deep voice. "Who pitched that ear at me? It's well it's the beer and not the pot as hit me, or I'd have settled somebody. I might have knowed as a nobody but an infernal, rich, plundering, thundering old Jew could afford to throw away any drink but water, and not that unless he'd done the river company every quarter. What's it all about, Fagin? Damn me, if my neck handkerchief ain't lined with beer. Come in, you sneaking warmint. What are you stopping outside for, as if you was ashamed of your master? Come in." The man who growled out these words was a stoutly built fellow of about 35, in a black velveteen coat, very soiled drab breeches, lace-up half-boots, and gray cotton stockings which enclosed a bulky pair of legs, with large, swelling calves. The kind of legs in which such costume always looked in an unfinished and incomplete state without a set of fetters to garnish them. He had a brown hat on his head and a dirty belcher handkerchief round his neck, with the long frayed ends of which he smeared the beer from his face as he spoke. He disclosed, when he had done so, a broad, heavy countenance with a beard of 3 days' growth and two scowling eyes, one of which displayed various parti-colored symptoms of having been recently damaged by a blow. "Come in, do you hear?" growled this engaging ruffian. A white shaggy dog, with his face scratched and torn in 20 different places, skulked into the room. "Why didn't you come in afore?" said the man. "You're getting too proud to own me afore company, are you? Lie down." This command was accompanied by a kick, which sent the animal to the other end of the room. He appeared well used to it, however, for he coiled himself up in a corner very quietly, without uttering a sound, and winking his very ill-looking eyes 20 times in a minute, appeared to occupy himself in taking a survey of the apartment. "What are you up to? Ill-treating the boys, you covetous, avaricious, insatiable old fence," said the man, seating himself deliberately. "I wonder they don't murder you. I would if I was them. If I'd been your prentice, I'd have done it long ago. And, no, I couldn't have sold you afterwards. For you're fit for nothing but keeping as a curiosity of ugliness in a glass bottle, and I suppose they don't blow glass bottles large enough." "Hush, hush, Mr. Sykes," said the Jew, trembling. "Don't speak so loud." "None of your mistering," replied the ruffian. "You always mean mischief when you come to that. You know my name. Out with it. I shan't disgrace it when the time comes." "Well, well, then, Bill Sykes," said the Jew, with abject humility. "You seem out of humor, Bill." "Perhaps I am," replied Sykes. "I should think you was rather out of sorts, too, unless you mean as little harm when you throw pewter pots about as you do when you blab and—" "Are you mad?" said the Jew, catching the man by the sleeve and pointing towards the boys. Mr. Sykes contented himself with tying an imaginary knot under his left ear and jerking his head over on the right shoulder, a piece of dumb show which the Jew appeared to understand perfectly. He then, in cant terms, with which his whole conversation was plentifully besprinkled, but which would be quite unintelligible if they were recorded here, demanded a glass of liquor. "And mind you don't poison it," said Mr. Sykes, laying his hat upon the table. This was said in jest, but if the speaker could have seen the evil leer with which the Jew bit his pale lip as he turned around to the cupboard, he might have thought the caution not wholly unnecessary, or the wish, at all events, to improve upon the distiller's ingenuity not very far from the old gentleman's merry heart. After swallowing two or three glasses of spirits, Mr. Sykes condescended to take some notice of the young gentleman, which gracious act led to a conversation, in which the cause and manner of Oliver's capture were circumstantially detailed, with such alterations and improvements on the truth, as to the dodger appeared most advisable under the circumstances. "I'm afraid," said the Jew, "that he may say something which will get us into trouble." "That's very likely," returned Sykes, with a malicious grin. "You're blowed upon, Fagin." "I'm afraid, you see," added the Jew, speaking as if he had not noticed the interruption, and regarding the other closely as he did so, "I'm afraid that, if the game was up with us, it might be up with a good many more, and that it would come out rather worse for you than it would for me, my dear." The man started and turned round upon the Jew, but the old gentleman's shoulders were shrugged up to his ears, and his eyes were vacantly staring on the opposite wall. There was a long pause. Every member of the respectable coterie appeared plunged in his own reflections, not excepting the dog, who by a certain malicious licking of his lips seemed to be meditating an attack upon the legs of the first gentleman or lady he might encounter in the streets when he went out. "Somebody must find out what's been done to the office," said Mr. Sykes, in a much lower tone than he had taken since he came in. The Jew nodded assent. "If he hasn't peached and isn't committed, there's no fear till he comes out again," said Mr. Sykes, "and then he must be taken care on. You must get hold of him somehow." Again the Jew nodded. The prudence of this line of action, indeed, was obvious, but unfortunately there was one very strong objection to it being adopted. This was that the Dodger and Charlie Bates and Fagin and Mr. William Sykes happened, one and all, to entertain a violent and deeply rooted antipathy to going near a police office on any ground or pretext whatsoever. How long they might have sat and looked at each other, in a state of uncertainty not the most pleasant of its kind, is difficult to guess. It is not necessary to make any guesses on the subject, however, for the sudden entrance of the two young ladies, whom Oliver had seen on a former occasion, caused the conversation to flow afresh. "The very thing," said the Jew. "Bet we'll go, won't you, my dear?" "Where's?" inquired the young lady. "Only just up to the office, my dear," said the Jew coaxingly. It is due to the young lady to say that she did not positively affirm that she would not, but that she merely expressed an emphatic and an earnest desire to be blessed, if she would. A polite and delicate evasion of the request, which shows the young lady to have been possessed of that natural good breeding which cannot bear to inflict upon a fellow creature the pain of a direct and pointed refusal. The Jew's countenance fell. He turned from this young lady, who was gaily, not to say gorgeously attired, in a red gown, green boots, and yellow curl papers, to the other female. "Nancy, my dear," said the Jew in a soothing manner, "what do you say?" "That it won't do, so it's no use of trying it on, Fagin," replied Nancy. "What do you mean by that?" said Mr. Sykes, looking up in a surly manner. "What I say, Bill," replied the lady collectedly. "Why, you're just the very person for it," reasoned Mr. Sykes. "Nobody about here knows anything of you." "And as I don't want him to, neither," replied Nancy in the same composed manner. "It's rather more no than yes with me, Bill." "She'll go, Fagin," said Sykes. "No, she won't, Fagin," said Nancy. "Yes, she will, Fagin," said Sykes. And Mr. Sykes was right. By dint of alternate threats, promises, and bribes, the lady in question was ultimately prevailed upon to undertake the commission. She was not, indeed, withheld by the same considerations as her agreeable friend, for having recently removed into the neighborhood of Field Lane from the remote but genteel suburb of Ratcliffe, she was not under the same apprehension of being recognized by any of her numerous acquaintances. Accordingly, with a clean white apron tied over her gown and her curl papers tucked up under a straw bonnet, Both articles address being provided from the Jews an inexhaustible stock. Miss Nancy prepared to issue forth on her errand. "Stop a minute, my dear," said the Jew, producing a little covered basket. "Carry that in one hand. It looks more respectable, my dear." "Give her a door key to carry in her other one, Fagin," said Sikes. "It looks real and Genovine-like." "Yes, yes, my dear, so it does," said the Jew, hanging in a large street door key on the forefinger of the young lady's right hand. "There, very good. Very good indeed, my dear," said the Jew, rubbing his hands. "Oh, my brother, my poor, dear, sweet, innocent little brother," exclaimed Nancy, bursting into tears and wringing the little basket and the street door key in an agony of distress. "What has become of him? Where are they taking him to? Oh, do have pity, and tell me what's been done with the dear old boy, gentlemen. Do, gentlemen, if you please, gentlemen." Having uttered these words in a most lamentable and heartbroken tone, to the immeasurable delight of her hearers, Miss Nancy paused, winked to the company, nodded smilingly around, and disappeared. "Ah, she's a clever girl, my dears," said the Jew, turning round to his young friends and shaking his head gravely, as if in mute admonition to them, to follow the bright example they had just beheld. "She's an honor to her sex," said Mr. Sikes, filling his glass and smiting the table with his enormous fist. "Here's her health, and wishing they was all like her." While these and many other encomiums were being passed on the accomplished Nancy, that young lady made the best of her way to the police office, whither, notwithstanding a little natural timidity, consequent upon walking through the streets alone and unprotected, she arrived in perfect safety shortly afterwards. Entering by the back way, she tapped softly with a key at one of the cell doors and listened. There was no sound within, so she coughed and listened again. Still, there was no reply, so she spoke. "Nolly, dear," murmured Nancy in a gentle voice. "Nolly?" There was nobody inside but a miserable, shoeless criminal who had been taken up for playing the flute, and who, the offense against society having been clearly proved, had been very properly committed by Mr. Fang to the House of Correction for 1 month, with the appropriate and amusing remark that since he had so much breath to spare, it would be more wholesomely expended on the treadmill than in a musical instrument. He made no answer, being occupied mentally bewailing the loss of the flute, which had been confiscated for the use of the county. So Nancy passed on to the next cell and knocked there. "Well," cried a faint and feeble voice. "Is there a little boy here?" inquired Nancy, with a preliminary sob. "No," replied the voice. "God forbid." This was a vagrant of 65, who was going to prison for not playing the flute, or, in other words, for begging in the streets, and doing nothing for his livelihood. In the next cell was another man, who was going to the same prison for hawking tin saucepans without license, thereby doing something for his living, in defiance of the stamp office. But, as neither of these criminals answered to the name of Oliver, or knew anything about him, Nancy made straight up to the bluff officer in a striped waistcoat, and with the most piteous wailings and lamentations, rendered more piteous by a prompt and efficient use of the street door key and the little basket, demanded her own dear brother. "I haven't got him, my dear," said the old man. "Where is he?" screamed Nancy, in a distracted manner. "Why, the gentleman's got him," replied the officer. "What gentleman?" "Oh, gracious heavens, what gentleman?" exclaimed Nancy. In reply to this incoherent questioning, the old man informed the deeply affected sister that Oliver had been taken ill in the office, and discharged in consequence of a witness having proved the robbery to have been committed by another boy, not in custody, and that the prosecutor had carried him away, in an insensible condition, to his own residence, of and concerning which all the informant knew was that it was somewhere in Pentonville, he having heard that word mentioned in the directions to the coachman. In a dreadful state of doubt and uncertainty, the agonized young woman staggered to the gate, and then, exchanging her faltering walk for a swift run, returned by the most devious and complicated route she could think of, to the domicile of the Jew. Mr. Bill Sikes no sooner heard the account of the expedition delivered than he very hastily called up the white dog, and, putting on his hat, expeditiously departed, without devoting any time to the formality of wishing the company good morning. "We must know where he is, my dears. He must be found," said the Jew, greatly excited. Charlie, do nothing but skulk about till you bring home some news of him. Nancy, my dear, I must have him found. I trust to you, my dear, to you and the artful for everything. Stay, stay, added the Jew, unlocking a drawer with his shaking hand. There's money, my dears. I shall shut up this shop tonight. You'll know where to find me. Don't stop here a minute. Not an instant, my dears. With these words, he pushed them from the room, and carefully double-locking and barring the door behind them, drew from its place of concealment the box, which he had unintentionally disclosed to Oliver. Then he hastily proceeded to dispose the watches and jewelry beneath his clothing. A rap at the door startled him in this occupation. "Who's there?" he cried in a shrill tone. "Me," replied the voice of the Dodger, through the keyhole. "What now?" cried the Jew impatiently. "Is he to be kidnapped to the other ken, Nancy says?" inquired the Dodger. "Yes," replied the Jew. "Wherever she lays hands on him. Find him. Find him out, that's all. I shall know what to do next. Never fear." The boy murmured a reply of intelligence and hurried downstairs after his companions. "He has not peached so far," said the Jew, as he pursued his occupation. "If he means to blab us among his new friends, we may stop his mouth yet."
Chapter 14. Compromising further particulars of Oliver's stay at Mr. Brownlow's with the remarkable prediction which one Mr. Grimwig uttered concerning him when he went out on an errand. Oliver, soon recovering from the fainting fit into which Mr. Brownlow's abrupt exclamation had thrown him, the subject of the picture was carefully avoided, both by the old gentleman and Mrs. Bedwin, in the conversation that ensued, which indeed bore no reference to Oliver's history or prospects, but was confined to such topics as might amuse without exciting him. He was still too weak to get up to breakfast, but when he came down into the housekeeper's room next day, his first act was to cast an eager glance at the wall, in the hope of again looking on the face of the beautiful lady. His expectations were disappointed, however, for the picture had been removed. "Ah," said the housekeeper, watching the direction of Oliver's eyes, "it is gone, you see." "I see it is, ma'am," replied Oliver. "Why have they taken it away?" "It had been taken down, child, because Mr. Brownlow saw that as it seemed to worry you, perhaps it might prevent your getting well, you know," rejoined the old lady. "Oh, no, indeed. It didn't worry me, ma'am," said Oliver. "I like to see it. I quite loved it." "Well, well," said the old lady good-humoredly. "You get well as fast as ever you can, dear, and it shall be hung up there. There, I promise you that. Now, let us talk about something else." That was all the information Oliver could obtain about the picture at that time. As the old lady had been so kind to him in his illness, he endeavored to think no more of the subject just then. So he listened attentively to a great many stories she told him about an amiable and handsome daughter of hers who was married to an amiable and handsome man and lived in the country, and about a son who was a clerk to a merchant in the West Indies, and who was also such a good young man and wrote such dutiful letters home 4 times a year that it brought the tears into her eyes to talk about them. When the old lady had expatiated a long time on the excellences of her children and the merits of her kind, good husband besides, who'd been dead and gone, poor dear soul, just 26 years, it was time to have tea. After tea, she began to teach Oliver cribbage, which he learnt as quickly as she could teach, and at which game they played with great interest and gravity, until it was time for the invalid to have some warm wine and water with a slice of dry toast and then go cozily to bed. There were happy days, those of Oliver's recovery. Everything was so quiet and neat and orderly, everybody so kind and gentle, that after the noise and turbulence in the midst of which he had always lived, it seemed like heaven itself. He was no sooner strong enough to put his clothes on properly than Mr. Brownlow caused a complete new suit, and a new cap, and a new pair of shoes to be provided for him. As Oliver was told that he might do what he liked with the old clothes, he gave them to a servant who had been very kind to him, and asked her to sell them to a Jew and keep the money for herself. This she very readily did, and as Oliver looked out of the parlor window and saw the Jew roll them up in his bag and walk away, he felt quite delighted to think that they were safely gone, and that there was now no possible danger of his ever being able to wear them again. They were sad rags, to tell the truth, and Oliver had never had a new suit before. One evening, about a week after the affair of the picture, as he was sitting talking to Mrs. Bedwin, there came a message down from Mr. Brownlow that if Oliver Twist felt pretty well, he should like to see him in his study and talk to him a little while. "Bless us and save us! Wash your hands, and let me part your hair nicely for you, child," said Mrs. Bedwin. "Dear heart alive! If we had known he would have asked for you, we would have put you a clean collar on and made you as smart as sixpence." Oliver did as the old lady bade him, and although she lamented grievously, meanwhile there was not even time to crimp the little frill that bordered his shirt-collar. He looked so delicate and handsome, despite that important personal advantage, that she went so far as to say, looking at him with great complacency from head to foot, that she really didn't think it would have been possible, on the longest notice, to have made much difference in him for the better. Thus encouraged, Oliver tapped at the study door. On Mr. Brownlow calling to him to come in, he found himself in a little back room, quite full of books, with a window looking into some pleasant little gardens. There was a table drawn up before the window, at which Mr. Brownlow was seated reading. When he saw Oliver, he pushed the book away from him and told him to come near the table and sit down. Oliver complied, marveling where the people could be found to read such a great number of books as seemed to be written to make the world wiser, which is still a marvel to more experienced people than Oliver Twist every day of their lives. "There are a good many books, are there not, my boy?" said Mr. Brownlow, observing the curiosity with which Oliver surveyed the shelves that reached from the floor to the ceiling. "A great number, sir," replied Oliver. "I never saw so many." "You shall read them if you behave well," said the old gentleman kindly, "and you will like that better than looking at the outsides, that is, some cases, because there are books of which the backs and covers are by far the best parts." "I suppose they are those heavy ones, sir," said Oliver, pointing to some large quartos, with a good deal of gilding about the binding. "Not always those," said the old gentleman, patting Oliver on the head and smiling as he did so. "There are equally heavy ones, though of a much smaller size. How should you like to grow up a clever man and write books, eh?" "I think I would rather read them, sir," replied Oliver. "What? Wouldn't you like to be a book writer?" said the old gentleman. Oliver considered a little while, and at last said he should think it would be a much better thing to be a bookseller, upon which the old gentleman laughed heartily and declared he had said a very good thing, which Oliver felt glad to have done, though he by no means knew what it was. "Well, well," said the old gentleman, composing his features, "don't be afraid. We won't make an author out of you while there's an honest trade to be learnt or brick making to turn to." "Thank you, sir," said Oliver. At the earnest manner of his reply, the old gentleman laughed again and said something about a curious instinct, which Oliver, not understanding, paid no great attention to. "Now," said Mr. Brownlow, speaking, if possible, in a kinder, but at the same time in a much more serious manner than Oliver had ever known him assume yet, "I want you to pay great attention, my boy, to what I am going to say. I shall talk to you without any reserve, because I am sure you are well able to understand me as many older persons would be." "Oh, don't tell you are going to send me away, sir, pray!" exclaimed Oliver, alarmed at the serious tone of the old gentleman's commencement. "Don't turn me out the doors to wander in the streets again. Let me stay here and be a servant. Don't send me back to the wretched place I came from. Have mercy upon a poor boy, sir!" "My dear child," said the old gentleman, moved by the warmth of Oliver's sudden appeal, "you need not be afraid of me deserting you, unless you give me cause." "I never, never will, sir," interposed Oliver. "I hope not," rejoined the old gentleman. I do not think you ever will. I have been deceived before in the objects whom I have endeavored to benefit, but I feel strongly disposed to trust you nevertheless, and I am more interested in your behalf than I can well account for, even to myself. The persons on whom I have bestowed my dearest love lie deep in their graves. But, although the happiness and delight of my life lie buried there too, I have not made a coffin of my heart and sealed it up forever on my best affections. Deep affliction has but strengthened and refined them. As the old gentleman said this in a low voice, more to himself than to his companion, and as he remained silent for a short time afterwards, Oliver sat quite still. "Well, well," said the old gentleman at length in a more cheerful tone, "I only say this because you have a young heart. And knowing that I have suffered great pain and sorrow, you will be more careful, perhaps, not to wound me again. You say you are an orphan, without a friend in the world. All the inquiries I have been able to make confirm the statement. Let me hear your story, where you came from, who brought you up, and how you got into the company in which I found you. Speak the truth, and you shall not be friendless while I live." Oliver's sobs checked his utterance for some minutes. When he was on the point of beginning to relate how he had been brought up at the farm and carried to the workhouse by Mr. Bumble, a peculiarly impatient little double knock was heard at the street door, and the servant running upstairs announced Mr. Grimwig. "Is he coming up?" inquired Mr. Brownlow. "Yes, sir," replied the servant. "He asked if there were any muffins in the house, and when I told him yes, he said he had come to tea." Mr. Brownlow smiled, and turning to Oliver, said that Mr. Grimwig was an old friend of his, and he must not mind him being a little rough in his manners, for he was a worthy creature at bottom, as he had reason to know. "Shall I go downstairs, sir?" inquired Oliver. "No," replied Mr. Brownlow. "I would rather you remained here." At this moment there walked into the room, supporting himself by a thick stick, a stout old gentleman, rather lame in one leg, who was dressed in a blue coat, striped waistcoat, nankeen breeches and gaiters, and a broad-brimmed white hat with the sides turned up with green. A very small plaited shirt frill stuck out from his waistcoat, and a very long steel watch-chain with nothing but a key at the end dangled loosely below it. The ends of his white neckerchief were twisted into a ball about the size of an orange. The variety of shapes into which his countenance were twisted defied description. He had a manner of screwing his head on one side when he spoke, and of looking out of the corners of his eyes at the same time, which irresistibly reminded the beholder of a parrot. In this attitude he fixed himself the moment he made his appearance, and, holding out a small piece of orange peel at arm's length, exclaimed in a growling, discontented voice, "Look here, do you see this? Isn't it a most wonderful and extraordinary thing that I can't call at a man's house, but I find a piece of this poor surgeon's friend on the staircase? I've been lamed with an orange peel once, and I know orange peel will be my death, or I'll be content to eat my own head, sir." This was the handsome offer with which Mr. Grimwig backed and confirmed nearly every assertion he made, and it was the more singular in his case, because even admitting for the sake of argument the possibility of scientific improvements being brought to the pass which will enable a gentleman to eat his own head in the event of his being so disposed, Mr. Grimwig's head was such a particularly large one that the most sanguine man alive could hardly entertain a hope of being able to get through it at a sitting, to put entirely out of the question, a very thick coating of powder. "I'll eat my head, sir," repeated Mr. Grimwig, striking his stick upon the ground. "Hello, what's that?" looking at Oliver and retreating a pace or two. "This is young Oliver Twist, whom we were speaking about," said Mr. Brownlow. Oliver bowed. "You don't mean to say that's the boy who had the fever, I hope," said Mr. Grimwig, recoiling a little more. "Wait a minute! Don't speak! Stop!" continued Mr. Grimwig, abruptly losing all dread of the fever in his triumph at the discovery. "That's the boy who had the orange! If that's not the boy, sir, who had the orange and threw this bit of peel upon the staircase, I'll eat my head and his, too!" "No, no, he has not had one," said Mr. Brownlow, laughing. "Come, put down your hat and speak to my young friend." "I feel strongly on this subject, sir," said the irritable old gentleman, drawing off his gloves. "There's always more or less orange peel on the pavement in our street, and I know it's put there by the surgeon's boy at the corner. A young woman stumbled over a bit last night and fell against my garden railings. Directly she got up, and I saw her look towards his infernal red lamp with the pantomime light. 'Don't go to him,' I called out the window. 'He's an assassin, a man-trap.' 'So is he. If he is not—' And here the irascible old gentleman gave a great knock on the ground with his stick, which was always understood by his friends to imply the customary offer, whenever it was not expressed in words. Then, still keeping his stick in his hand, he sat down and, opening a double eyeglass, which he wore attached to a broad black ribbon, took a view of Oliver, who, seeing that he was the object of inspection, colored and bowed again. "That's the boy, is it?" said Mr. Grimwig at length. "That's the boy," replied Mr. Brownlow. "How are you, boy?" said Mr. Grimwig.
A great deal better, thank you, sir," replied Oliver.
Mr. Brownlow, seeming to apprehend that his singular friend was about to say something disagreeable, asked Oliver to step downstairs and tell Mrs. Bedwin that they were ready for tea, which, as he did not half like the visitor's manner, he was very happy to do. "He's a nice-looking boy, is he not?" inquired Mr. Brownlow.
"I don't know," replied Mr. Grimwig pettishly.
"Don't know?"
"No, I don't know. I never see any difference in boys. I only knew two sorts of boys, mealy boys and beef-faced boys."
"And which is Oliver?"
"Mealy.
I know a friend who is a beef-faced boy. A fine boy, they call him, with a round head and red cheeks and glaring eyes. A horrid boy with a body and limbs that appear to be swelling out of the seams of his blue clothes, with the voice of a pilot and the appetite of a wolf. I know him, the wretch."
"Come," said Mr. Brownlow, "these are not the characteristics of young Oliver Twist, so he needn't excite your wrath."
"They are not," replied Mr. Grimwig. "He may have worse."
And here Mr. Brownlow coughed impatiently, which appeared to afford Mr. Grimwig the most exquisite delight. "He may have worse, I say," repeated Mr. Grimwig. "Where does he come from? Who is he? What is he? He has had a fever? What of that? Fevers are not peculiar to good people, are they? Bad people have fevers sometimes, haven't they? Eh? I knew a man who was hung in Jamaica for murdering his master. He had a fever 6 times. He wasn't recommended to mercy on that account. Pooh! Nonsense!" Now, the fact was that in the inmost recesses of his own heart, Mr. Grimwig was strongly disposed to admit that Oliver's appearance and manner were unusually prepossessing. But he had a strong appetite for contradiction, sharpened on this occasion by the finding of the orange peel, and inwardly determining that no man should dictate to him whether a boy was well-looking or not, he had resolved from the first to oppose his friend. When Mr. Brownlow admitted that on no one point of inquiry could he yet return a satisfactory answer, and that he had postponed any investigation to Oliver's previous history until he thought the boy was strong enough to hear it, Mr. Grimwig chuckled maliciously, and he demanded with a sneer whether the housekeeper was in the habit of counting the plate at night, because if she didn't find a tablespoon or two missing some sunshiny morning, why, he would be content to, and so forth. All this Mr. Brownlow, although himself somewhat of an impetuous gentleman, knowing his friend's peculiarities, bore with great good humor. As Mr. Grimwig at tea was graciously pleased to express his entire approval of the muffins, matters went on very smoothly, and Oliver, who made one of the party, began to feel more at his ease than he had yet done in the fierce old gentleman's presence.
And when are you going to hear a full, true, and particular account of the life and adventures of Oliver Twist? Asked Grimwig of Mr. Brownlow at the conclusion of the meal, looking sideways at Oliver as he resumed his subject. Tomorrow morning, replied Mr. Brownlow. I would rather he was alone with me at the time. Come up to me tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, my dear. Yes, sir, replied Oliver. He answered with some hesitation because he was confused by Mr. Grimwig's looking so hard at him. I'll tell you what, whispered that gentleman to Mr. Brownlow. He won't come up to you tomorrow morning. I saw him hesitate. He is deceiving you, my good friend. I'll swear he was not, replied Mr. Brownlow warmly. If he is not, said Mr. Grimwig, I'll... And down went the stick. I'll answer for that boy's truth with my life, said Mr. Brownlow, knocking the table. And I for his falsehood with my head, rejoined Mr. Grimwig, knocking the table also. We shall see, said Mr. Brownlow, checking his rising anger. We will, replied Mr. Grimwig with a provoking smile. We will. As fate would have it, Mrs. Bedwin chanced to bring in, at this moment, a small parcel of books, which Mr. Brownlow had that morning purchased of the identical bookstall keeper who had already figured in this history. Having laid them on the table, she prepared to leave the room. Stop the boy, Mrs. Bedwin, said Mr. Brownlow. There is something to go back. He is gone, sir, replied Mrs. Bedwin. Call after him, said Mr. Brownlow. It's particular. He's a poor man, and they are not paid for it. There are some books to be taken back, too. The street door was opened. Oliver ran one way, and the girl ran another, and Mrs. Bedwin stood on the step and screamed for the boy. But there was no boy in sight. Oliver and the girl returned in a breathless state to report that there were no tidings of him. Dear me, I'm very sorry for that, exclaimed Mr. Brownlow. I particularly wish those books to be returned tonight. Send Oliver with them, said Mr. Grimwig, with an ironical smile. He will be sure to deliver them safely, you know. Yes, do let me take them, if you please, sir, said Oliver. I'll run all the way, sir. The old gentleman was just going to say that Oliver should not go out on any account when a most malicious cough from Mr. Grimwig determined him that he should, and that, by his prompt discharge of the commission, he should prove to him the injustice of his suspicions. On this head, at least, at once. You shall go, my dear, said the old gentleman. The books are on a chair by my table. Fetch them down. Oliver, delighted to be of use, brought down the books under his arm in a great bustle, and waited, cap in hand, to hear what message he was to take. You are to say, said Mr. Brownlow, glancing steadily at Grimwig, you are to say that you have brought these books back, and that you have come to pay the £4.10 I owe him. This is a £5 note, so you will have to bring me back 10 shillings change. I won't be 10 minutes, sir, said Oliver eagerly, having buttoned up the bank note in his jacket pocket and placed the books carefully under his arm. He made a respectable bow and left the room. Mrs. Bedwin followed him to the street door, giving him many directions about the nearest way and the name of the bookseller and the name of the street, all of which Oliver said he clearly understood. Having superadded many injunctions to be sure and not take cold, the old lady at length permitted him to depart. Bless his sweet face, said the old lady, looking after him. I can't bear somehow to let him go out of my sight. At this moment, Oliver looked gaily around and nodded before he turned the corner. The old lady smilingly returned his salutation and closed the door and went back to her own room. Let me see. He'll be back in 20 minutes at the longest, said Mr. Brownlow, pulling out his watch and placing it on the table. It'll be dark by that time. Oh, you really expect him to come back, do you? Inquired Mr. Grimwig. Don't you? Asked Mr. Brownlow, smiling. The spirit of contradiction was strong in Mr. Grimwig's breast at the moment, and it was rendered stronger by his friend's confident smile. No, he said, smiting the table with his fist, I do not. That boy has a new suit of clothes on his back, a set of valuable books under his arm, and a £5 note in his pocket. He'll join his old friends, the thieves, and laugh at you. If ever the boy returns to this house, sir, I'll eat my head. With these words, he drew his chair closer to the table, and there the two friends sat, in silent expectation, with the watch between them. It is worthy of remark, as illustrating the importance we attach to our own judgments, and the pride with which we put forth our most rash and hasty conclusions, that, although Mr. Grimwig was not by any means a bad-hearted man, and though he would have been unfeigning sorry to see his respected friend duped and deceived, he really did most earnestly and strongly hope at that moment that Oliver Twist might not come back. It grew so dark that the figures on the dial plate were scarcely discernible, but there the two old gentlemen continued to sit in silence with the watch between them.
Chapter 15, showing how very fond of Oliver Twist the merry old Jew and Miss Nancy were. In the obscure parlor of a low public house, in the filthiest part of Little Saffron Hill, a dark and gloomy den, where a flaring gaslight burnt all day in the wintertime, and where no ray of sun ever shone in the summer, there sat, brooding over a little pewter measure and a small glass, strongly impregnated with the smell of liquor, a man in a velveteen coat, drab shorts, half boots, and stockings, who even by that dim light, no experienced agent of police would have hesitated to recognize as Mr. William Sykes. At his feet sat a white-coated red-eyed dog, who occupied himself alternately in winking at his master with both eyes at the same time, and in licking a large fresh cut on one side of his mouth, which appeared to be the result of some recent conflict. "Keep quiet, you warmint! Keep quiet," said Mr. Sykes, suddenly breaking silence. Whether his meditations were so intense as to be disturbed by the dog's winking, or whether his feelings were so wrought upon by his reflections that they required all the relief derivable from kicking an unoffending animal to allay them, is matter for argument and consideration. Whatever was the cause, the effect was a kick and a curse, bestowed upon the dog simultaneously. Dogs are not generally apt to revenge injuries inflicted upon them by their masters, but Mr. Sykes' dog, having faults of temper in common with his owner and laboring, perhaps at this moment, under a powerful sense of injury, made no more ado but at once fixed his teeth in one of the half-boots. Having given it a hearty shake, he retired, growling, under a form, just escaping the pewter measure which Mr. Sykes leveled at his head. "You would you?" said Sykes, seizing the poker in one hand and deliberately opening with the other a large clasp knife, which he drew from his pocket. "Come here, you born devil. Come here, do you hear?" The dog no doubt heard, because Mr. Sykes spoke in the very harshest key of a very harsh voice, but appearing to entertain some unaccountable objection to having his throat cut, he remained where he was and growled more fiercely than before, at the same time grasping the end of the poker between his teeth and biting at it like a wild beast. This resistance only infuriated Mr. Sykes the more, who, dropping on his knees, began to assail the animal most furiously. The dog jumped from right to left and from left to right, snapping, growling, and barking. The man thrust and swore and struck and blasphemed, and the struggle was reaching a most critical point for one or other, when, the door suddenly opening, the dog darted out, leaving Bill Sykes with the poker and the clasp knife in his hands. "There must always be two parties to a quarrel," says the old adage. Mr. Sykes, being disappointed of the dog's participation, at once transferred his share in the quarrel to the newcomer. "What the devil do you come in between me and my dog for?" said Sykes with a fierce gesture. "I didn't know, my dear, I didn't know," replied Fagin humbly, for the Jew was the newcomer. "Didn't know, you white-livered thief," growled Sykes. "Couldn't you hear the noise?" "Not a sound of it, as I'm a living man, Bill," replied the Jew. "Oh, no, you hear nothing, you don't," retorted Sykes with a fierce sneer. "Sneaking in and out, so as nobody hears how you come or go. I wish you had been the dog, Fagin, half a minute ago." "Why?" inquired the Jew with a forced smile. "'Cause the government, as cares for the lives of such men as you, as haven't half the pluck of curs, lets a man kill a dog how he likes." replied Sykes, shutting up the knife with a very expressive look. That's why. The Jew rubbed his hands, and sitting down at the table, affected to laugh at the pleasantry of his friend. He was obviously very ill at ease, however. Grin away, said Sykes, replacing the poker and surveying him with savage contempt. Grin away. You'll never have the laugh at me, though, unless it's behind a nightcap. I've got the upper hand over you, Fagin, and damn me, I'll keep it. There, if I go, you go, so take care of me. Well, my dear, said the Jew, I know all that. We have a mutual interest, Bill, a mutual interest. Said Sykes, as if he thought the interest lay rather more on the Jew's side than on his. Well, what have you got to say to me? It's all passed safe through the melting pot, replied Fagin, and this is your share. It's rather more than it ought to be, my dear, but as I know you'll do me a good turn another time and... Stow that gammon, interposed the robber impatiently. Where is it? Hand over. Yes, yes, Bill, give me time, replied the Jew soothingly. Here it is, all safe. As he spoke, he drew forth an old cotton handkerchief from his breast, and untying a large knot in one corner, produced a small brown paper packet. Sykes, snatching it from him, hastily opened it, and proceeded to count the sovereigns it contained. "This is all, is it?" inquired Sykes. "All," replied the Jew. "You haven't opened the parcel and swallowed one or two as you come along, have you?" inquired Sykes suspiciously. "Don't put on an injured look at the question. You've done it many a time. Jerk the tinkler." These words, in plain English, conveyed an injunction to ring the bell. It was answered by another Jew, younger than Fagin, but nearly as vile and repulsive in appearance. Bill Sykes merely pointed to the empty measure. The Jew, perfectly understanding the hint, retired to fill it, previously exchanging a remarkable look with Fagin, who raised his eyes for an instant, as if in expectation of it, and shook his head in reply, so slightly that the action would have been almost imperceptible to an observant third person. It was lost upon Sykes, who was stooping at the moment to tie the boot lace which the dog had torn. Possibly, if he had observed the brief interchange of signals, he might have thought that it boded no good to him. "Is anybody here, Barney?" inquired Fagin, speaking now that Sykes was looking on, without raising his eyes from the ground. "Dot a shoal," replied Barney, whose words, whether they came from the heart or not, made their way through the nose. "Nobody?" inquired Fagin, in a tone of surprise, which perhaps might mean that Barney was at liberty to tell the truth. "Nobody but Miss Dadsey," replied Barney. "Nancy!" exclaimed Sykes. "Where? Strike me blind if I don't honor that air girl for her native talents." "She's been having a plate of boiled beef at the bar," replied Barney. "Send her here," said Sykes, pouring out a glass of liquor. "Send her here." Barney looked timidly at Fagin as if for permission, the Jew remaining silent, and not lifting his eyes from the ground, he retired and presently returned, ushering in Nancy, who was decorated with the bonnet, apron, basket, and street door key complete. "You are on the scent, are you, Nancy?" inquired Sykes, proffering the glass. "Yes, I am, Bill," replied the young lady, disposing of its contents, "and tired enough of it I am, too. The young brat's been ill and confined to the crib, and..." "Ah, Nancy, dear," said Fagin, looking up. Now, whether a peculiar contraction of the Jew's red eyebrows and a half-closing of his deeply set eyes warned Miss Nancy that she was disposed to be too communicative, it's not a matter of much importance. The fact is all we need care for here, and the fact is that she suddenly checked herself, and with several gracious smiles upon Mr. Sykes, turned the conversation to other matters. In about 10 minutes' time, Mr. Fagin was seized with a fit of coughing, upon which Nancy pulled her shawl over her shoulders and declared it was time to go. Mr. Sykes, finding that he was walking a short part of the way himself, expressed his intention of accompanying her. They went away together, followed at a little distance by the dog, who slunk out of a backyard as soon as his master was out of sight. The Jew thrust his head out of the room door when Sykes had left it, looked after him as he walked up the dark passage, shook his clenched fist, muttered a deep curse, and then with a horrible grin, reseated himself at the table, where he was soon deeply absorbed in the interesting pages of the Hue and Cry. Meanwhile, Oliver Twist, little dreaming that he was within so very short a distance of the merry old gentleman, was on his way to the bookstall. When he got into Clerkenwell, he accidentally turned down a by street, which was not exactly in his way, but not discovering his mistake until he had got halfway down it, and knowing it must lead in the right direction, he did not think it worth while to turn back, and so marched on as quickly as he could with the books under his arm. He was walking along, thinking how happy and contented he ought to feel, and how much he would give for only one look at poor little Dick, who, starved and beaten, might be weeping bitterly at that very moment, when he was startled by a young woman screaming out very loud, "Oh, my dear brother!" And he had hardly looked up to see what the matter was, when he was stopped by having a pair of arms thrown tight round his neck. "Don't!" cried Oliver, struggling. "Let go of me! Who is it? What are you stopping me for?" The only reply to this was a great number of loud lamentations from the young woman who had embraced him and who had a little basket and a street door key in her hand. "Oh, my gracious," said the young woman, "I found him. Oh, Oliver, Oliver, oh, you naughty boy, to make me suffer sich distress on your account. Come home, dear, come. Oh, I found him. Thank gracious goodness heavens, I found him." With these incoherent exclamations, the young woman burst into another fit of crying, and got so dreadfully hysterical that a couple of women who came up at the moment asked a butcher's boy with a shiny head of hair anointed with suet, who was also looking on, whether he didn't think he had better run for the doctor. To which the butcher's boy, who appeared of a lounging, not to say indolent disposition, replied that he thought not. "Oh, no, no, never mind," said the young woman, grasping Oliver's hand. "I'm better now. Come home directly, you cruel boy, come." "What's the matter, ma'am?" inquired one of the women. "Oh, ma'am," replied the young woman, "he ran away near a month ago from his parents, who are hard-working and respectable people, and went and joined a set of thieves and bad characters, and almost broke his mother's heart." "Young wretch," said one woman. "Go home, do, you little brute," said the other. "I am not," replied Oliver, greatly alarmed. "I don't know her. I haven't any sister or father and mother either. I'm an orphan. I live at Pentonville." "Only hear him, how he braves it out," cried the young woman. "Why, it's Nancy," exclaimed Oliver, who now saw her face for the first time, and started back in irrepressible astonishment. "You see, he knows me," cried Nancy, appealing to the bystanders. "He can't help himself. Make him come home. There's good people, or he'll kill his dear mother and father and break my heart." "What's the devil's this?" said a man, bursting out of a beer shop with a white dog at his heels. "Young Oliver, come home to your poor mother, you young dog. Come home directly." "I don't belong to them. I don't know them. Help, help," cried Oliver, struggling in the man's powerful grasp. "Help," repeated the man. "Yes, I'll help you, you young rascal. What books are these? You've been a-stealing them, have you? Give them here." With these words, the man tore the volumes from his grasp and struck him on the head. "That's right," cried a looker-on from a garret window. "That's the only way of bringing him to his senses." "To be sure," cried a sleepy-faced carpenter, casting an approving look at the garret window. "It'll do him good," said the two women. "And he shall have it, too," rejoined the man, administering another blow and seizing Oliver by the collar. "Come on, you young villain. Here, bullseye, mind him, boy, mind him." Weak with recent illness, stupefied by the blows and the suddenness of the attack, terrified by the fierce growling of the dog and the brutality of the man, overpowered by the conviction of the bystanders that he really was the hardened little wretch he was described to be, what could one poor child do? Darkness had set in. It was a low neighborhood. No help was near. Resistance was useless. In another moment, he was dragged into a labyrinth of dark, narrow courts, and was forced along them at a pace which rendered the few cries he dared to give utterance to unintelligible. It was of little moment, indeed, whether they were intelligible or no, for there was nobody to care for them. Had they been ever so plain? The gas lamps were lighted. Mrs. Bedwin was waiting anxiously at the open door. The servant had run up the street 20 times to see if there were any traces of Oliver, and still the two old gentlemen sat perseveringly in the dark parlor with the watch between them.